I wonder how you feel when you're waiting for a particular event to happen, a big event in your life. I can see smiles. We've each got our own scenario in our heads, haven't we? It could be, I hate to mention it, could be exams. It could be a wedding day, maybe a driving test, or a job interview, or first day at a new school. And so it goes on, doesn't it? How do you feel when you've got that in front of you? Or something like that. Nervous? Or excited? Or scared? I guess it depends on the event, doesn't it? What the event is and how much you're looking forward to it. And you've got all the efforts and the careful planning and the preparation and the nervous anticipation and the waiting impatiently. And then finally, this is it. The time arrives. Let's go. No more planning. No more prep. It's all done. The time's here. Seeing the baby carrier there, I guess it's a bit like having a baby, isn't it? The time comes, it's going to happen. All the prep is done. Well, the time, the event, and the climax has finally now come, says Jesus, in verse 45, Matthew chapter 26, just a verse or two before we started reading today. The time has come. But to understand what that time is, I guess it's worth, again, as we've done a number of times, and Spencer's done with us, is just looking back to see what is the time and how everything that Matthew has been writing about here since chapter 1 is pointing towards this time and the next few hours of Jesus' life. Flick back with me. We'll do three or four minutes of page flicking, and then we'll give your fingers a rest. Just flick back again to Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1. Right at the start of Matthew's Gospel, then just before that long list of names which Matthew gives to us, which we wrongly think as being boring, they are very, very important lists of names showing Jesus' genealogy and the line. Matthew says in chapter 1, this is a record of the genealogy of Jesus. Jesus what? Jesus the Christ, the promised one. This is the one that God has promised to send. Chapter 2, the next page, in verse 6, and what will he be? As prophesied and quoted here, he will be the shepherd of my people Israel, the promised one. And we've gone on to see how Jesus taught his disciples, he called his disciples, he showed them the way to live, he talked about the kingdom of heaven. And if you flick across to Matthew chapter 16 and verse 16, where finally it seems the disciples start to get it. Who is Jesus? Is he just a teacher? Is he just some good teacher? Yes, another prophet? What is he? And he says to them in verse 13 of chapter 16 in Matthew, he says, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And some said John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, one of the prophets. But what about you, Jesus asked? Who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter, we'll come across him later on this morning, he said, you are the Christ, the promised one, the Messiah, the Son of God. What a claim that was for him to make. And then on to verse 21 and 23 in chapter 16, where Jesus began to explain to his disciples from that time that he must go to Jerusalem and that he must die. He's not here to lead a political party or political rising or to take Jerusalem by force. No, he's come to die and must suffer and rise again. On to chapter 26, closer to where we are this morning. We looked at this just a few weeks back. Jesus again, verse 1 of chapter 26, again he says he must be handed over to be crucified. Verses 1 and 2, the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. Verse 21, Jesus says that one of his disciples will betray him. And verse 26, as we saw just last week, I think it was, the week before, that will be Judas. You see, Jesus knows all these things, and he's predicting them, and he's warning the disciples and preparing them for the great event that's going to happen. Verse 31 of chapter 26, where Jesus quotes from the Old Testament. He says, this very night, you will all fall away on account of me. I will be deserted by you, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, I that is God. God will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. They will desert him. Peter protests and says, verse 33, even if all fall away on account of you, I never will. I tell you the truth, says Jesus, verse 34, this very night, before the cock crows, you will disown me three times. And then, as Jonathan mentioned in the passage we looked at just last week, Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane and he prays there with some of his disciples, deeply aware of the huge enormity of the task ahead of him and what he's about to face. He knows what he's about to face. Matthew writes that his soul was overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. And three times he prays, as in verse 39. And he prays, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup, the cup of wrath of God's judgment, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." So Jesus prepares himself for the reason he came, to suffer and to die for us. So the hour is near, verse 45, when he comes back from praying and he says to the disciples, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour is near. The time has come. We are ready now. The Son of Man is betrayed. Rise, let us go and meet my betrayer." Which is our first point to look at this morning, how Jesus was betrayed. And the start, that's really the start of his suffering and the humiliation that he will go through over the next 12 hours in time. That's hard for us to imagine, isn't it, to think that all that he went through, he knew what was going to happen. He knew the intensity and the suffering he was going to have to go through in those 12 hours. You know, it's a hurtful thing to be betrayed by someone you love and know and trust, isn't it? Maybe some of us know something of that to greater or lesser degrees, to be let down. And it comes as a slap in the face. And it's humiliating. Judas was not an outsider, was he? We know a little bit about him from the Gospels. He was one of the 12 disciples. He was one who had been with Jesus for more than 3 years. Certainly the past 3 years of Jesus' ministry, he had spent a lot of time with those disciples. Judas had been with Jesus and with the other disciples. He'd listened to Jesus' teaching. He'd seen the miracles. They'd shared experiences together. They'd shared meals together. They'd traveled the country together. He'd seen Jesus' life at first hand. And now in verse 46, with the insincere greeting of a kiss as he comes to Jesus and identifies him, he betrays Jesus, betrayed by one of his own disciples, one of his inner circle of 12. And as he comes leading an armed crowd in the dark of night to Jesus and his disciples. And it looks like this is the end, isn't it? If you're expecting the event to be great and exciting victory, which I think the disciples probably were, suddenly it seems to have all gone wrong. Here they are, dark of night, outnumbered by Roman soldiers and others who are armed. The game must be up and Jesus is arrested. What an anticlimax this seems to be. What a humiliation for them and for Jesus. But you know, if you look at it, the actions of Judas who betrays Jesus and the follow-on actions of the disciples, particularly one of the disciples in verse 51, who we know from the other Gospels to be Peter himself, their actions show that they've still not understood or accepted why Jesus came. They still haven't got that in their heads. They still haven't understood that this is all God's will. Jesus had warned them, we've just seen that he had to come and die. He'd warned them they'd all fall away. But they refused to understand and accept that. And now, Jesus knows what's happening, and the time has come for him to be betrayed and to be handed over. This is what he said would happen. But yet their view and their understanding of Christ, of Jesus, is wrong. And I wonder how often that's true for us too, isn't it? We all come with our own views, understandings of who Jesus should be and what he should do and what I want him to be. But, you know, being betrayed, for them, Jesus being betrayed, this didn't fit with their view of what Jesus was supposed to be there for. This wasn't supposed to happen. This doesn't fit with my view of the Christ, the Messiah, the one who's going to rescue Israel, be our king and our leader, the promised one. No, he should be victorious. What's gone wrong here? Do you remember how Peter responded to Jesus earlier in Matthew 16? We looked at some of those verses earlier on. Jesus said to them that he had to suffer and die. And what did Peter say? "Never, Lord. No way. That's not going to happen. You've got it wrong." And what was Jesus' response to him? Do you remember? Jesus turned to him and he strongly rebuked him. And he said to him, "Get behind me, Satan." Jesus recognized that was none other than an attack by the devil to undermine his purpose and what he came to do. And he said to Peter, "You don't have in mind the things of God. You don't understand God's plan. You have in mind the things of men. Peter was still thinking here. The disciples are still thinking man's plans, not God's plans here. And in spite of all the previous warning, what does Peter do? Draws his sword, reaches out and strikes off the ear of one of the servants of the high priest. He still does not accept that Jesus must suffer. Well, you may know from the other Gospels that Jesus healed that man and he put the ear back on the high priest's servant, which may have saved Peter's skin that night for sure. But, you know, this wasn't God's plan to die in a skirmish in the woods at night, was it? I don't know what Peter and others were thinking. But Jesus didn't come to die that way. He wasn't the leader of an armed gang or a terrorist cell or a bunch of guys trying to take the authorities by storm. He wasn't someone hiding. As he says, he'd sat in the temple courts day after day, and they hadn't come to find him then. So why did they come at night seeking him as if he was some hidden refugee who they finally tracked down? He didn't come to die with others in that way, in that kind of battle. He didn't come to die that way so the disciples could say, bravely, we stood by him and we fought in battle and we died next to him, trying to protect and save him. No. Jesus didn't come for that. He came to die alone. He came to face betrayal on his own, alone. And he came to face suffering alone. And they didn't yet understand that. You see, Jesus knew exactly what was happening. He knew exactly all the awful things that were going to happen to him over those next 12 to 18 hours into the next day when he was finally crucified and hung on the cross. He knew the humiliation he would suffer of being betrayed. But he was determined to do God's will. He knew God's will, and his face was set to doing what God wanted him to do. So this is not a reluctant surrender by Jesus. This is not, oh, the game's up, got me guys, quick change of plan. Look what Jesus says in verse 53, when we read that, where he said, do you not think I could call more than 12 legions of angels right now? And we were just discussing earlier on, how many is 12 legions? And depending on your math and how you work it out, either way, it's an awful lot of soldiers, or in Roman army terms. It may be something like 72,000. In this context, Jesus is saying, do you think that I don't have more than 12 legions? What's the point here? He's not saying my resources are limited to 12 legions of angels. Jesus is saying, my resources are endless here. I could, at the snap of my fingers, at one command, I could instruct all the powers at my disposal, all the powers of heaven, to dismiss these people, to freeze them in stone, to turn them away, to disarm them. Do you not think that Jesus, who could turn water into wine, or who could calm the storm, he could calm the wind and the waves, who could heal blind and lame people, and who could raise Lazarus from the dead, do you not think he could get out of this if he really wanted to? Of course he could. Of course he could. But he chose not to. This was Jesus in control, obeying his Father. He was in complete control, submitting himself to his enemies and to God. You see, it was for us he was betrayed and rejected. For us that he came. But you know, the disciples who had not yet fully understood or accepted Jesus' true mission now take him to the high priest, who has his own misunderstandings, doesn't he, about Jesus, as Jesus appears before the court. And right from the start, as you see in verse 59, these guys were not interested in the truth. Their intent was not truth and justice, but, as we see from our second point, to condemn Jesus to death. If ever there's a case of rough justice, and we've seen lots of them on the news, haven't we, over the past, well, as long as we've been alive, and obviously in previous generations too, people who have been falsely tried, false evidence brought to the courts, people wrongly convicted, put in prison, maybe sometimes executed. And years later, it turns out that actually the evidence was cooked. If ever there's a case of rough justice, this is going to be it, isn't it? Surely? You see, they'd made up their minds already what the outcome should be. Look at what they say in verse 59. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin, the council, the ruling council, were looking for false evidence against Jesus. Why? So that they could put him to death. They've made their minds up already what the outcome was going to be. They were not interested in truth. They were not really looking for true evidence as to, well, who is this bloke? Or what has he really done? Does he deserve death? Or is he innocent? No. All they want is information to support their case. You know, how many people down the years since Caiaphas, the high priest, have done exactly the same thing, have the same attitude towards Jesus? Maybe we have that. Maybe you have that. What's your attitude to Jesus? Where perhaps you've already made up your mind about Jesus. Oh, he's just a good teacher. Oh, he doesn't exist. And you're only really actually wanting to hear the evidence that supports your current view. Ah, you see, have you heard about this one here, this conspiracy theory or that one? I want to hear that one, but I don't want to hear the truth, just like Caiaphas the high priest. Well, the evidence for Jesus is overwhelming. And some of the questions I guess we'll look at it Wednesday night are going to start to unpack some of those questions. And those are really important questions for us, whether we're Christians or not yet Christians, to be able to ask and look at. Because if the evidence is not there, if Jesus is not the Son of God, if he is not the truth, well, then we ought to know about that. And as Paul said, then we are fools. But if he is the Son of God, and if he did come to die for us because we need a Savior, then that's the truth, and we need to accept the truth. But the scene here must have been absolutely chaotic. Can you imagine the different false witnesses being brought up? And as Matthew says, you know, they tried to find false witnesses, but verse 60, but they couldn't find any, although many false witnesses came forward. You can imagine them coming forward. Oh, I heard him say this. Oh, I think this. Oh, I think he's this. If you look at Mark's gospel, he adds a bit more detail to what Matthew says here in verse 60. And Mark says in chapter 14, don't turn to it now, but he says that although many gave testimony, their statements did not agree. Can you imagine the chaos? And in keeping with the scriptural biblical principle of needing two witnesses to agree before you can prosecute and condemn someone who you have an accusation against, finally Matthew says, verse 61, he says, finally two came forward and said, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Well, did that stick? We've looked at it closely, actually, even this charge is not accurate. You may be thinking, now those words sound familiar. I've come across those words somewhere in the New Testament before. But the charge is not accurate. And again, Mark helps us to understand that in his gospel, where he says, even then their testimonies did not agree. So we have these two who have a similar story, but actually their testimonies did not agree. They don't have two people who can agree on what they'll accuse Jesus of. But it's worth us taking a quick look at where that charge came from, what it's based on. Since as the words we read, they look familiar. Destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. We've seen that before somewhere, haven't we? Turn with me to John's Gospel, page 749. John chapter 2, page 749, if you're using the church Bibles. John chapter 2, and we'll just pick up a few verses from verse 12. Now, this is the account you may remember, and you'll see as we read through, where Jesus comes to the temple, into the temple courts, and when he comes there, he finds that rather than people worshipping God and it being a place of prayer and worship to God, he finds it's been turned into a market with people buying and selling, trading money, trading animals, an absolute disgrace. And as you recall, and you skim through those verses, you see there in verse 13, so he made a whip out of cords and drove them from the temple area, both sheep and cattle, and scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. Verse 16, to those who sold doves, he said, get out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market? And his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. But the Jews demanded of him, what gives you the right to do that? What miraculous sign can you show us to prove you've got authority to walk in here and do that? What does Jesus say to them? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. Now, a claim of intent to destroy the temple would have met with an outcry from them. And he would have been arrested probably on the spot. But Jesus did not say he would destroy the temple. He said, destroy it, i.e., you destroy it, and I will rebuild it. And that's clearly how they understood it to be taken. Because if you look at verse 20 in John chapter 2, what did they say? They didn't say, how can you break it down in 3 days? Or who gives you the right to break it down? No, they said, how can you rebuild it in 3 days? It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days? They had no query about the destruction of the temple, and they weren't accusing him or saying he would do it. But they were amazed that he could even think about rebuilding it in three. And it also not understood, as John writes in verse 21, he said, but the temple he, Jesus, had spoken of was not the building, it was his body. And after he was raised from the dead, the disciples recalled what he had said, and they understood what he meant. So the charge that they are making back in Matthew 26 here is neither true, because that's not what Jesus said, and nor could the witnesses agree on it. So since there's no testimony that could stick, Jesus remained silent, much to the annoyance of the high priest. And presumably, I guess, since there's no claim which they agreed on, he had no need to reply that. To answer false claims would have only given them some credibility, some legitimacy, and ended up in an argument about details which were actually wrong. So Jesus is silent, the silence of innocence and of trust in his Father as he submits his life to his Father. Well, that should have been thrown out of court, shouldn't it? Dismissed out of hand. But the high priest was determined to find reason to condemn Jesus. And his final demanding question, you can imagine him getting furious. And did he thump the table? I don't know. But if it was me, I would have thumped the table saying, come on, you've got to tell me the truth. There's a film I saw years ago. Some of you may know A Few Good Men. We see the film A Few Good Men. And there's one instance there, a court case. And it's only an illustration, but there's the accused. And the attorney's accusing him, thumping the table, saying, I demand to know the truth. What does the high priest do here? He's actually not after the truth. It's not the truth he's after. But he wants to find a way of catching out Jesus and giving him a reason to condemn him to death. We've already seen that, haven't we, back in verse 59. So what does he do? Well, in the law of Moses, you can look it up in Leviticus chapter 24 later on. Don't turn to it. Where the law says, the one who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. So if Jesus had blasphemed, or if any man had blasphemed, then yes, they should be put to death. That was God's law. And they would have been within their rights to apply that law. The high priest says to him, answer me truthfully. In the presence of God, answer me truthfully. Are you the Son of God? Well, Jesus answered truthfully, but the high priest didn't want the truth, did he? You see, to claim to be God would be blasphemous, wouldn't it? Unless, of course, the claim is true, which for Jesus it is, because he was the Son of God. When he said, I am the Son of God, he was speaking the truth. That's not blasphemy. He was the Son of God. And the problem is the high priest just could not take that, could he? He didn't want the truth. What he didn't want was Jesus. But Jesus' reply is interesting, isn't it? When you look to see what he said back to the high priest in verse 64. What does Jesus do? Not only does he say, yes, he is the Son of God, but he turns the tables on him. He goes one step further and he says, yes, he says, it is as you say. You know I am, and it's as you say. But he says that while he may stand there today, while Jesus may stand there today as one who is condemned by them, he warns them of a great reversal of roles that will happen in the future, verse 64. And he quotes from Daniel. Turn back to Daniel quickly, worth just taking a look at this. Daniel chapter 7 in the Church Bibles, page 626. Page 626, Daniel chapter 7. And Jesus is quoting from this passage. We looked at this some months ago, and we won't clearly go into the whole chapter. But if you look at Daniel chapter 7 and verse 13, which is where Jesus is quoting from, the vision that Daniel saw. And in verse 13, Daniel says, he says, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days," the Ancient of Days being God, "and was led to his presence," into his presence. "He was given authority." Who was given authority? The Son of Man, Jesus. "He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power, and all peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." That's the vision that Daniel saw, that God gave to Daniel. That's the prophecy. And the high priest now sees Jesus and is condemning Jesus to death. Where's it all gone wrong? Have the wheels come off the wagon? No, Jesus says to them, "One day you will see me as the Son of Man," as he says to the high priest. "No longer on trial, as I am today, standing, the defendant and accused, but I will be seated at the right hand of God." And he says, "You may see me under God's judgment today. You may judge me under God wrongly, but you will see me seated at God's right hand, the place of power. You may judge and condemn me to death, but I will rise again, and I will come in power and glory, our King." The ones who were ultimately on trial that day, it wasn't Jesus. Actually, ultimate trial were those who stood judging the perfect and sinless Son of God, Jesus. Well, what was their response? What was the response to that? Infuriated. It should have been to fall on their faces in front of him, shouldn't it? They should have realized. They knew the scriptures. They knew the prophecies. They'd seen his life. They'd seen the evidence. They knew the truth. But they refused to obey him. They should have asked for mercy and to be forgiven. But instead, they condemned him to death. There you go. What more evidence do you need? See, he claims to be Jesus. He claims to be God's son. He should be put to death. And so they decide, summarily, he is worthy of death. Well, it was a vicious attack, wasn't it, as they start to bully him, spitting in his face, which was considered one of the worst insults you could give someone, apart from being highly unpleasant. It was an insult, degrading. Spitting in his face, slapping, punching, hitting, mocking him. "Go on then, who hit you?" As the other Gospels tell us, he was blindfolded. Well, if you're the Christ and you're blindfolded, well, you should know who hit you, shouldn't you? Whack! "Go on then, who hit you?" Sheer bullying, wasn't it? So why did he stand there and allow all that to happen to him? Why did he stand there, silent and suffering? Everything had been predicted years before, hadn't it? We saw some of that back in Isaiah. And Isaiah writes also in chapter 50. Don't turn to this, let me just read this to you. In Isaiah chapter 50, and verse 6. Where Isaiah prophesies and he says, "I offered my back to those who beat me, and my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting." He knew what he'd come to do. It's amazing, isn't it, to think that that level of detail was written 700 years beforehand. The level of brutality, the details of the spitting, the punching, the hitting, pulling his beard. And Jesus, knowing all of that, willingly went through the suffering for us. He was betrayed by one of his disciples. He was condemned and humiliated by the court. And then the final humiliation, and I guess a sorry downturn for Peter, as Jesus had predicted, he is disowned by Peter. We'll look at this very briefly. As we've seen, that by this stage, the disciples had all already fled back in verse 56. And instead of their brave insistence in the previous chapter, they would stand by him, that they'd all stick by him to the death. They all said it. they'd already fled before Jesus got to the Sanhedrin and to the high priest, except for one, Peter, who follows at a distance. No doubt he was shocked by the betrayal. No doubt he was shaken by his own attack, having pulled out his sword and cut off the high priest's servant's ear and seen the blood, and the soldiers no doubt baying for his blood. He would have been shocked by that. But he still wanted to see what was going to happen. But I don't want to get too close. This is dangerous. So he keeps at a safe distance, Matthew tells us, sitting out in the courtyard in verse 69. And three times he's questioned, as you read earlier on, three times he's questioned, aren't you with Jesus? Weren't you there? Aren't you one of them? Three times he denies it. He doesn't just keep silent. He doesn't dodge the question. No, he denies it. And as he does so, he tries to move further away, back out to the gateway in verse 71. Yet again, he's challenged. You see, he tries to keep his head down, doesn't he? He's there, but he's not there. Isn't it like us? You know, we can condemn Peter, we can look back at him, can't we, and say, oh, foolish Peter, how could he have disowned Jesus? How silly he was. Where would you have been? Where would you have been? I don't know where I would have been, but I would have been with the other 11, or 10, as it was then. Maybe with Peter, but I wouldn't like to claim to have been any better than Peter, standing in his own strength there. But aren't we still like that today, as Christians, so often? Especially in this country where, what worries do we have? Sure, lots of Christians around the world are facing persecution, death, imprisonment by identifying with Jesus. And what do we have to fear by identifying with Jesus for us today? A bit of ridicule? A bit of embarrassment? Maybe we're not being thought of as quite so cool? Yeah, being teased at school? What did Peter have to put up with? What was Jesus putting up with? You know, the reason those people thought that Peter had been with Jesus was things like his accent or his behavior or who he'd hung around with. Who do you hang around with at school, at work, with your neighbors? His accent. He was from that area. Surely you're one of them. Your accent gives you away. You're from that bunch with them, aren't you? What's our accent? I don't mean Wiltshire or whatever. But what's the accent of our lives and how we live? What's the fragrance that comes off from us, the way we speak and live our lives? As someone once said, is there enough evidence to convict you of being a Christian? To convict me of being a Christian? Do my colleagues know? Do the guys at school know I'm a Christian? There's a challenge to us, isn't there? We can look at Peter and say, he disowned Jesus. But how many times in a day or a week do we disown him by the things we say and do, or by the things that we don't say and do, by not stepping up and doing the right things, by not sharing the good news of the people? How often do we fail Jesus in that same way? Well, the third time, Peter strongly denies ever having known Jesus, doesn't he? What a shock. And what happens? Just as Jesus said, straight away the cock crows. You know, Jesus knew when the cock would crow, and Jesus knew that Peter would betray him and how he'd react. Why? Or how? Because Jesus is none other than the Son of God. He knows all things, and he's perfect. And when the cock crows, Peter remembers what Jesus said, and he sees himself for exactly what he is, a weak deserter. Yeah, Luke tells us in his gospel that when the cock crowed, Jesus turned and he looked directly at Peter. And Peter then remembered what Jesus said and he wept. So where did Peter go wrong? Where did he go wrong in all that? Peter thought he could stand in his own strength. He thought he could do it his way. He knew the way, but Jesus warned him he would fail. Yet Peter thought he was there to save and protect his Lord, didn't he? I'll be there for you, Lord. I'll go to the death with you. I'll fight for you. But he had to come to realize that it was not Jesus who needed saving, was it? No. It was only Jesus who could save Peter. It was only Jesus who could save Peter and who can save you and me. And to do that, Jesus had to go to the cross alone. Betrayed, condemned, and disowned, but yet in control, and our King and our Savior. What a Savior we have, don't we?